Oh, good evening or morning or afternoon, depending on where you all are today. We're at the last evening of this retreat, and I get to talk about the first on our list. So we've been going through this Sun Sutta, that which is the forerunner and the precursor to the arising of the Noble Eightfold Path, similar to the dawn as the forerunner and precursor of the rising of the sun. And the very first on the list in the sutta is good friendship, Kalyanamitta. So Kalyana is often translated as beautiful or good. Mitta is friend. And last night, Gil spoke about Yoniso Manisikara, and in some ways we could consider that this internal support, internal accomplishment, if you like that word. And then we have Kalyanamitta as this outer support in our practice and in our lives. And oftentimes, people new to Buddhism, especially in the West, kind of consider this, the Dharma, to be this sort of individual path of spiritual development. You know, here we all are, kind of silent, not speaking to each other, oftentimes not even looking at one another. But we can feel the support of each other here. And if we look at the Buddhist texts over and over again, there was this emphasis of the value of spiritual friendship as a support on the Buddhist path for the entire course of practice. I imagine that a number of you are familiar with the Kalyanamitta Sutta. It's the one where Ananda, who is the cousin and attendant of the Buddha and always seems to be such a kind of agreeable, kind, devoted friend and companion, attendant, and he came to the Buddha and was very excited to relay this insight he had, which was, he said, good sir, or sir, good friends, companions, and associates are half of the spiritual life. Yeah. And the Buddha replied, not so, Ananda, not so. Good friends, companions, and associates are the whole of the spiritual life. Not half, but whole of the spiritual life. So, how is this? You know, how do we have the good friend as the whole of the spiritual life? And for one, perhaps most obvious or evident is this sangha that we have. And even on the first day, Shelley led us through the refuges so beautifully, and she talked about sangha and how we have each other here supporting one another. It's so special. in the silence, it's in some ways even more palpable, the support that we have of one another here, you know, keeping us coming back to the practice, coming back to the sits. And beyond this retreat, Sangha is what keeps the teachings alive. We learn the teachings from each other through voice and through text, and they're passed along through mouths and hands. It's a very human lineage. And so much of this practice has been really formed around community, around monastic communities, taught in communities. So we have Sangha this way, these webs of support built in to our practice, already sort of indicating that it's beyond a path of self-interest or personal acquisition or need. I think Gil used these words. I'm not sure, but they've stuck with me, that it's about living a life of mutual benefit. Practice is living a life of mutual benefit. And I know for myself, I would never have kept going if I didn't have spiritual friends and mentors and teachers that I could talk to and learn from. And so many of us come to this practice because of suffering, you know, recognizing that life is difficult and we're also vulnerable in various ways, and this sort of necessity to have each other to keep going. And it happens all the way from birth. You know, it's like we wouldn't even survive as infants without just this enormous amount of help. Physical help and psychological help, the encouragement and guiding and companionship. Like, really takes a lot of effort to be a whole human. And then we all need the more than humans, the air and the plants and the water and all the planetary beings that comprise our Sangha. I have a good friend, such a kind-hearted, creative, warm, open person, and he has a history of just very severe trauma. His childhood was really hard, and I remember in introducing him to a mentor of mine. And after some amount of talking, it came out, he shared a bit about his background. And my mentor asked him, who showed up for you as a mentor or a teacher or an inspiration when you were young? And he asked that because, and I mean, I learned from it. I hadn't thought to ask my friend this. My friend responded with these stories I had never heard. You know, a music teacher who had really taken him under his wing, and a neighbor friend who had him over every now and again and really showed, encouraged him in various ways. But it was like my mentor knew that in order for this person to have become such a good-hearted, honest, tender individual, he had to have had some support. He had to have had someone seeing that goodness in him. Because if we don't, we see those who experience such harm and they don't have that. We see how closed their hearts can become. You know, the pain of that. And I think even beyond humans, you know, serving as that mentor or teacher, I often think of non-humans sometimes as helping in that regard. Animals coming and showing up, reminding us of our animal nature. That's my own orientation. But Ajahn Suchito, he didn't use these words that I did, but he was in a talk, he was describing what it is to ask for help. And he writes, "So maybe this is how God or Kuan Yin or the Absolute are sending their help, by putting us in situations where we will learn to help each other." You know, when we need help, putting us in situations where we will learn to help each other. And he goes on, "At any rate, in terms of Buddhist practice, this is what communion is about." Communion, community. So, Kalyanamitta, spiritual friendship. There's another sutta about friendship that I really like because it's so unusual. It's this story of this young monk, Migya, who's serving as the Buddha's attendant, which is kind of unusual because it's usually Ananda. And he finds this really beautiful, peaceful mango grove, and he comes back to the Buddha and asks if he can meditate there. He's really eager about meditating there, and the Buddha says, "No, don't leave me," which again is kind of unusual because he spent a lot of time on his own. But Migya asks three times, and typically if you ask three times, the Buddha relents. And so he did. He said, "Okay, go meditate." And Migya went to this beautiful mango grove and meditated, but he didn't have a beautiful, peaceful meditation. His mind was just filled with confusion and aversion and greed, and he came back to the Buddha, and the Buddha wasn't surprised to hear this, but he offered Migya a teaching, and he said, "Five things induce release of heart and lasting peace. First, a lovely intimacy with good friends." I can go on if you're curious. "The second is virtuous conduct. The third is frequent conversation that inspires and encourages practice. The fourth, diligence, energy, and enthusiasm for the good. And fifth, insight into impermanence." But then the Buddha goes on and he goes through the list again, but he precedes each of the other items with the first. So, "When there is a lovely intimacy between friends, then there is virtuous conduct," you know, all the way down. So, in other words, the friendship piece is this most important element here in the teaching, and that everything else, you know, like the water filling the creeks and rivers and oceans, flows from it. So, mentioning that, you know, we need each other for just basic survival and support and companionship amidst the turbulence of this world. But we also need spiritual friends who are really, I mean, the spiritual part, who are really invested in our freedom, in our peace, you know, to help us along this path of spiritual development. And one of the qualities I think most important in this is those who really see the goodness in us. I've worked as a teacher for a long time now, and not in the spiritual path teaching teacher, but it's a college professor and a naturalist and other arenas. But I think it relates or overlaps, because I've found that one of the most important aspects of teaching is really to believe in my students. Maybe some of you who are teachers kind of feel this too. It's like it's not coming from a place of insincerity. It's like I actually really do. And I really train myself to see the innate goodness in them. And I probably do that because I've been on the receiving end of that. And I don't know if I hadn't been how easy it would have been to cultivate that faith in my own self. I mean, we'll never know, but it's an extraordinary gift to have people who see the goodness in each other. This is from Thich Nhat Hanh. Our practice should be supported by the people around us, and we can learn how to support them in return. We support them by looking deeply so we can recognize the seeds of peace, joy, and loving kindness in them. We touch these seeds and we water these seeds every day in order to make other people bloom like flowers. And when these people bloom like flowers, we all become happier. So those who encourage the goodness, who know the goodness in us, who know that capacity for awakening in us, who believe in that. Those are good spiritual friends. And then friends who also can shed light on our blind spots. You know, people who actually keep us accountable because we love each other, because we want the best for each other. This is where the practice, this is where good friendship becomes a practice. You know, can we really see and give honest feedback for each other's welfare out of compassion? With this openness that's given out of compassion, not irritation. And then can we receive that without defensiveness? You know, to be able to be seen very deeply and know that I won't be abandoned. Those are kind of high bar friend qualities and so important. Because we need to learn how to grow. And if we get, you know, if we're constantly scared of being seen, of making a mistake, you know, we'll never learn from that. And just to say, too, I said it already, but that it's a practice. You know, being a good friend is a practice. To receive feedback, to give feedback, to really come back to that understanding of, oh, this is another person just wanting to be loved, just as I want to be loved, affected by ignorance, just as I'm affected by ignorance. And so we can kind of model that for each other. Oh, this person showed up in a way that was so kind and compassionate and gave such good feedback. Maybe I can do that too. you know, being a good friend doesn't just happen for most people, I think. Adrienne Rich, who's a feminist poet and essayist, she wrote that an honorable human relationship, that is, one in which two people have the right to use the word love, is a process, delicate, violent, often terrifying to both persons involved, a process of refining the truths they can tell each other. It is important to do this because it breaks down human self-delusion and isolation. It is important to do this because in doing so, we do justice to our own complexity. It is important to do this because we can count on so few people to go that hard way with us. And then this is from the Dhammapada. If you find a wise person who points out your faults and corrects you, you should follow such a sage as you would a revealer of treasures. Two different versions of something, a similar sentiment there. And there's something about that lovely intimacy between friends that the Buddha spoke to, that there's this willingness and courage to meet each other at a heart level. It's like that quality of metta. I'm not pulling away, I'm not manipulating the experience. I'm not afraid. But we meet each other through the heart. And then when we meet each other's suffering, there's compassion. And when we meet each other's joy, there's empathetic joy. It's like this, these are these opportunities for the Brahma Viharas, these abodes of the heart to fruit. And in case you haven't sort of been catching on to this as I've been speaking, this is exactly what we're cultivating in meditation practice. You know, how do we meet our own experience with compassion and friendliness, with truth, with seeing things as they are, and with that tenderness, keeping the heart open. So there's a number of times in the sutta where there's encourage, or in the suttas where there's encouragement to keep the company of the wise and avoid the company of the foolish. It's kind of the usual translation, but you might choose to substitute words there if you choose. But the idea is to be with people who remind you of your own goodness, to be judicious about being around people who are tear you down or negative in certain ways that kind of can chip away at us. And this idea of us being so porous, like if you want to cultivate equanimity, you know, spend time with people who value equanimity. And if you want to cultivate compassion, spend time with those who value that or are compassionate. You know, it's one way of learning from each other. There's a little sutta the Mitta Sutta. It's sweet. It's this list of seven qualities of a good friend. So I'll list the seven and then say a few words. They give what is hard to give. They do what is hard to do. They endure what is hard to endure. They reveal their secrets to you. They keep your secrets. They don't abandon you in times of trouble. They don't look down on you in times of loss. And you know, these last four feel pretty straightforward to me. They reveal their secrets to you. They keep your secrets. They don't abandon you. They don't look down on you. And then the first three feel, they're a little more ambiguous, giving what is hard to give, doing what's hard to do, and enduring what is hard to endure. So I was reflecting on those three for a while. And then I was thinking, you know, well, what are the qualities necessary for giving what is hard to give? That doesn't really matter what the gift is, but the quality of giving that which is hard to give is generosity. Doing what is hard to do, maybe strength or fortitude or courage. Enduring what is hard to endure, like loyalty, patience. Staying with things, diligence. And then I was thinking, well, so those are, of course, you know, what beautiful qualities to have in a good friend. Someone who's generous and patient and loyal, who's there for us. And sometimes I think that one of the hardest gifts to give and one of the most valuable is our presence and this gift of being present. I think Gil mentioned in the first day that we offer this Buddhist eco-chaplaincy training program. And we offer these skills or trainings for people who are providing spiritual support for those who are contending with climate grief or anxiety, or people who have lost homes to floods or fire, or who are frontline activists and experiencing burnout. And one of the practices that we offer is really just offering presence to people. You know, maybe now and again asking a question. Maybe now and again suggesting some kind of practice. But really, it's just the gift of offering a full-hearted, unconditional presence to someone who's in pain. That can be so fundamentally transformative and healing. And it's also a practice, this offering of our presence, our non-judgmental, open-hearted presence. It helps us to understand our own emotions and perspectives. It helps us to develop a wider heart. And one of the beautiful things about the eco-chaplaincy too that I love is that we learn to listen to each other, our human kin, but there's also this invitation of listening to the earth. And I thought I would share something from this book, which I love. It's Alexis Pauline Gums wrote a book of essays called Undrowned, Black Feminist Lessons from Marine Mammals. And she is just in love with marine mammals. And so each chapter is devoted to a different one. And this one is river dolphins, and she has all of these beautiful words around how they use the fat in their foreheads to modulate their biosonar listening. Just kind of amazing. And this piece around listening. She writes, there's two pieces here that I just love. I can't decide if I'm going to read one or the other, or both of them. Says, I am humbly listening and I'm learning to take responsibility for my frequencies. I can lower them to reach you. I can reflect before I speak out. Echolocation is not the same as mind reading. Some of this magic is just the complexity of being a mammal alive in sound. I can hear what I cannot see yet. I can make a whole world of resonance and live in it, swim through it, reflecting you. Whistle, click, if you can feel that I am here. I'll just leave it there. So this listening, this art of offering each other our full presence, the gift of that, which I would consider one of the hardest things to give, again, is this practice of mindfulness. We're offering that presence to ourselves, you know, that kind of unconditional friendship, that kind of kindness. And when it gets hard, it's like that's when we need ourselves more than ever. You know, can we not abandon ourselves when it gets hard? I used to have a practice when I've had a lot of physical pain and illness in my life, and sometimes when it would get really bad, I would just sit here. I'm here now in this. Like, that's it. Those were the words. I am here now in this. And there's something about that like very simple mantra, I guess you could call it. It was like just making friends with myself and my experience. Like, I'm not going to go anywhere. This isn't comfortable, but I'm here now in this. Yeah, a way of really bringing our own Kalyanamitta home. Reminds me of the poem by Derek Walcott, Love After Love. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. So as we get ready to transition into the world here, now we can remember what it is to offer ourselves that tenderness and that truth. Offer that to each other. Maybe surround ourselves, if we can, with those who embody our values. Remember that we're not alone. And, you know, and knowing that we all have difficult and challenging relationships too. And here we are moving into holidays where that might be even more prominent. I think there's something about the inner fortitude, that yoniso manisikara, that profound attention that upwells from that deep place of knowing that we're whole, that we can stay steady and rooted in that place. And that helps us show up in our relationships with that kind of care and compassion and patience. You know, and if there's harmful speech, then there's not really anywhere for it to land. And if there's harmful action, then we care for ourselves and make a loving boundary. There's nothing inconsistent there. So Thich Nhat Hanh predicted that the next Buddha would be the Sangha. He wrote, it's possible the next Buddha will not take the form of an individual. The next Buddha may take the form of a community practicing understanding and loving kindness, a community practicing mindful living, and the practice can be carried out as a group, as a city, as a nation. I love that vision of the next Buddha being a Sangha. And there's something about that vision and something even about what we learn from Kalyanamitta as, again, one of these like first numbers on the lists. It's so foundational on this spiritual path. That this practice isn't so personal, actually. That we might think of awakening as an individual experience. But we learn that we practice together and understand together and awaken together. So I'll end with a part of a poem by Joy Harjo, and it's called Conflict Resolution for Holy Beings, and she has a number of points, and this is one of the points. It's number 4. I could hear the light beings as they entered every cell. Every cell is a house of the God of Light, they said. I could hear the spirits who love us stomp dancing. They were dancing as if they were here, and then another level of here, and then another, until the whole earth and sky was dancing. "We are here dancing," they said. There was no there. There was no I or you. There was us. There was we. There we were as if we were the music. You cannot legislate music to lockstep, nor can you legislate the spirit of the music to stop at political boundaries, or poetry, or art, or anything that is of value or matters in this world and the next worlds. This is about getting to know each other. We will wind up back at the blues, standing on the edge of the flatted fifth, about to jump into a fierce understanding together. So let's just sit in silence together for a minute. Thank you for your attention and for being in this practice together this week. It's a beautiful gift. I do have one announcement, which is that tonight's schedule is a little different. We're going to meet back here at 7:30, and everyone is asked to attend because there will be some closing announcements for that 7:30 sit. So it's 15 minutes earlier than usual.
Yeah. The bell ringer.
Oh, great. Yeah, bell ringer. Thank you. Perfect. See, we all just help each other out. Thank you so much.